The purpose of this session is to follow up on the session that I moderated yesterday and really go down a level actually start to think about solutions and how the technology can be applied. I think now that we know a lot more about it. But what I'd like to do is begin with a more of an explanation of what Higgins is, because one of the top questions was, what is Higgins? And we've seen a demonstration of it. But I think Paul can actually sort of talk to the general notion of what Higgins
is. I was hoping a picture was worth 1,000 words. I was hoping that...
You can't get off that lightly. Because I think people have a number of questions. They say, what is it, a Fisher Fowl? Is it a framework?
Okay.
Is it interoperability? It's been misrepresented a lot of different ways. I think it'd be good to get some clarity on that.
Okay. Officially, Higgins is a species of Tasmanian mouse, which is an extraordinarily long tail, and hence the choice of that as the logo. Higgins is also the name of a project at the Eclipse Foundation. The Eclipse Foundation, if you don't know, is one of the larger open source foundations, like Apache, you probably heard of that one, or Mozilla Foundation. And as such, its operating procedures and licensing and everything is absolutely standard Eclipse public license. Within that project, we work on... Let me start with a big picture. What you just saw, which is in the Higgins repository at the foundation, is something that shows all the parts. One of the parts was the browser extension, the Higgins browser extension. That will be an end user product. That's something that anyone can use. The part that you're looking at, the web app, is a Java-based web application that is built on top of, it's mostly a wrapper around the Higgins framework. What the framework is, we mean that in the sense of a piece of software. A framework is a piece of software that's very thin and defines APIs, that defines conventions as to how the Tinkertoy pieces that other people contribute to it plug into it. So in Higgins, it does not dictate any particular identity protocol. For example, in Higgins, if you wanted to use one of these cards to sign in to Amazon with a Microsoft card space protocol, you could do that because we've added support for that. The demonstration that I just did, we used an RSS feed. The way that the mashup site got your profile was through RSS. Actually, it's kind of interesting. We didn't use plain old RSS 2.0. We used Microsoft's Creative Commons licensed synchronization extension, simple synchronization extension, which allows bidirectional and incremental information. So what I showed you was the information flowing one way and the other way, but it can actually flow back and forth on two different channels going in each direction. Nope. So that would be another protocol that's plugged into the Higgins framework. And we've had conversations with developers of other protocols that could be plugged into it. And further, Higgins isn't just about identity and authentication. It also has a data abstraction layer in it. Because the kind of information that we would like to manage in the system is just about anything you can think of that's related to you. And I don't want to steal my own thunder, but there's a demo tonight where the people who, Louise and my virtual model, who are showing the 3D body and stuff, we want to work together to make you own your own body. We want to make you own your own kitchen. Tonight we'll demonstrate you owning your own kitchen. Your kitchen data is part of you, which means the data that describes a kitchen. Now, we have a very crude model of what your kitchen is. We have floor color and preferred brand and the shape of your kitchen and the countertop and a few things like that. You should be able to set up those preferences and then go shopping. And the in that case, we're using this as headless profile data, which means it's anonymized. So it's self-asserted. You know, my kitchen is a U-shape, and I'm the one who's saying that, and I go to Best Buy or to some other merchant, and lo and behold, they show me stuff that fits into a U-shaped kitchen. So I was giving an example of Higgins isn't just about authentication. It isn't just about single sign-on. In fact, if you noticed carefully in my demo, it didn't automatically sign you in, so we weren't showing that part of Higgins. There's going to be a demo that IBM is doing, which will show using Higgins and interoperating with Kim's.
Could you elaborate on that a little more?
I don't want to steal Tony's thunder, but
You just did.
It's done.
Okay, so I will say no.
He has enough damage.
Go for it, Paul.
So Kim's blog has become temporarily, literally, you're all thinking I mean his blog in one sense. Actually, a whole bunch of us just use it as a test site to see if we can sign into it with a cards-based icon. We never look at what he's writing, you know. If we can sign in, man, you know, we're there. And so literally, Kim has been fixing bugs in his blog, receiving code.
We aim to serve in whatever small ways we can.
So there's more to his blog than you might think. So we're going to demonstrate that. I'm not saying any more about that. There'll be a demonstration of the authentication use of Higgins tonight with the same basic software you're looking at here, using Cardspace protocols. Cardspace is the new name for InfoCard.
Yeah, Cardspace doesn't have protocols. Cardspace is just our implementation of protocols that are industry-wide. And so it's just a new... I shouldn't say that, but I mean...
It's really a Cardspace profile, yeah. I should have said.
So could you elaborate on what kind of, say, affinity or a federation opportunities or...
Well, the cool thing about Higgins is that it doesn't do much in and of itself. It's a framework, and that means that we leave it to open source community and developer community to build plugins that make it actually do something. And
you know what? We invented less than you invented. No, sorry.
That's the comment.
So
we invented less than you didn't invent. Anyway, no.
That is a huge compliment.
He's too humble.
I think it's tremendous. It's a framework, right?
Right. Yeah. And I think that reminds me of something. We believe that what Microsoft's done with Cardspace is, from a consistent user, from many dimensions, from the point of view of consistent user experience, you know, these guys have the ability to deploy, right? Hundreds of millions of desktops are going to find out that steering wheels go on the left and the gear shift goes on the right. And so we're going to build this Higgins. The part that we don't have built yet is the demos that Mike usually gives, which is the identity selector. But the back end, the front end, meaning the browser extension, those two pieces are done. The next thing we're going to do is build that identity selector so that you could fire this software up, because it's all written in Java, so you could fire it up on a Mac or on a Linux machine and log into the same sites that, at the very least, that level of interoperability, and we want to do much, much more than that.
You also mentioned that you have an anonymity. Is it, and could you elaborate on that when you call it headless anonymity? And what, because I think this is one of the questions that's come up in a larger context, is how the whole issue of privacy and how do you protect anonymity and the various types of anonymity, contextual-based anonymity, and we're trying to, there are a lot of issues that are brought up about privacy. And,
right. Well,
and
okay. The core organizing architectural point of Higgins is to divide the space into contexts. You know, one of the laws for, I think, is that you should have the minimal amount of information necessary to support the transaction. You know, if you can say, yes, the person's over 18, you don't have to give their age, as an example. So in Higgins, what we believe is that there should be as many contexts as possible, each of which has as little information about you as possible, and only the user is allowed to correlate identity across those. That's the trick. So in a lot of ways, you know, Higgins is an implementation of, you know, all of Kim's laws and some more on top. And anonymity is easily handled because if you've got multiple identities and you've got separate contexts, a digital identity as we define it is a set of claims about you. Those claims may or may not include identifying information. So, and tonight we'll do a demonstration of anonymous, headless surfing on the net to shop for a fridge. And there is no reason during that interaction that you have to reveal who you are. It's unnecessary.
Okay. Oh, yeah.
How do you prevent another party from correlating information across multiple transactions?
Hey, Tony.
Are you going to talk about dynamic stuff?
Well, that actually opens up a question that I, as an entree to a larger question, because there's been concerns expressed, particularly with Rebecca McKinnon's question about, okay, in a hostile environment. So do you have a friend? And You're a framework here, perhaps in Higgins or other means, to provide certain kind of technologies that prevent doing the linkability,
right.
and recognizing it is a it's a sort of predator prey cycle. Things are always changing. There's never a single solution. You can keep adding new components and upgrading the technology, and I think that's going to be an important component of this. And so, if you could speak to some of those issues.
Well, I can't say about something that's very exciting.
Go ahead.
So I can say a little bit right now. So we have Roger Zimmerman from the IBM Zurich Research Lab here, and he will at least tonight demonstrate the technology that's been used in the European Prime project for identity, which is IDE Mix, and how it can provide both privacy and lack of, you know, showing identities on various sites. So that will at least be a demonstration in after the main demonstrations. We'll be able to show that sets of technology. And so that technology is in the process of being contributed to the Eclipse Higgins project as open source. So I can't make a final commitment yet, but we're going through the legal aspects of committing that work.
That's great. I mean, I think one of the things that when we started involved in this identity project at the Berkman Center, a lot of people were very negative about it. And the whole idea is putting it, I mean, it was not a popular move in some people's circles because it felt it was going to make things worse. And so we're at a point where there is an identity layer that's coming in, and you're going to have to disclose yourself. What assurances can you sort of provide that things are not going to get worse, and that there's a framework, there's a way of augmenting it and dealing with some of these issues? I mean, can you really speak to that?
Before we get there, can I just answer that question from the point of view of the technology I've been working on too? Because, you know, it's important that it extend across the whole, all the different incarnations of this, let's say. So for example, we have a self-asserting identity provider, and when you go to a site, let's say you go to my blog site, it uses a strong crypto key to recognize you the next time you come back. What's different about this and previous uses of crypto is that the key at every site will be a different key. So we've tended to call this public key, right? The asymmetric key we've called public key. In this case, it's asymmetric, but it's secret because it refers to my relationship to one single entity. So at that point, that key can't be used as what we were yesterday calling a correlation handle. And the importance of that is there's now no magical technology glue linking your transactions. The transactions may still be linked because I give him my telephone number and him my telephone number. But as a human, I understand those things. Whereas I don't understand hidden technology glue at the bottom of the stack. So that's what we're trying to do there. And then similarly, you have, there are many, many ways of doing this, but in general, the principle would be that you have identifiers on it's what I call unidirectional identifiers, unless you're in a public role, like, okay, I'm blogging, so now I don't want to have a different email address for each of you.
Pick up on this. So do you think it's going to be what's going to happen to fishing and farming and some of the fraud? I mean, do you think that's really it's going to have a real effect on this?
Well, yes, it's going to have a huge effect, but this is a very complicated problem. The only way you can stop fishing, farming, and all those things, you have to fix about 1,000 things about our society. it's worth doing that. But, you know, it's tedious. So, you know, I think we've got to be careful as technologists not to think that we can solve all of the world's problems, you know, in some
Would you just elaborate on that? Because I mean, I manage expectations of what's going to be possible.
Okay.
And so there's certain things that the card or these.
The first thing that happens, and one of the reasons when we talk about when we've come together to say, well, we want to have a common steering wheel metaphor. You know where, or, you know, like you know where the steering wheel is. You know where the brakes are. It's so that we can better communicate with the human using the system. Right now we have technical systems that are very safe. You can have an extremely safe, impenetrable connection to an evildoer easily. It's just that you don't know that you're connected to somebody you don't want to be connected to. So why don't you? It's because that last little bit, which is the communication with the user, hasn't been clear enough. So one of the things we're trying to do, you know, between all of us, all the technologists on this panel, is to have a way that we can use strong cryptography to identify who you're dealing with, but very much improve the quality of the experience of communicating with the person. So what is that? So now there's a million ways you can do that. First of all, you can stop being obtuse. I mean, that's a good starting point. But you can also do things like keep the screen from being, you see, because, you know, right now the screen can be scraped. The enemy can overwrite your pixels. You can be looking at a screen and say, oh, that's okay, I know I've got a lock icon, but the lock icon was put there by the person who's attacking you. What is that bar or the address bar? Who put that there? Maybe I install an address bar which systematically attacks me. The address bar can be used, you know, as a very nice mechanism for feeding information to an attacker. So, okay, what I would say is, you know, if you go back and you look, when I go to Europe, I'm always amazed by the way the fortresses were built. And they have, you know, they have an outer wall, and then they have an inner wall, and then they have the pour the boiling oil over the attacker's wall, and then they have a tower and a dungeon and everything, and that's what we need. On day one, do we have every single possible wall built? No, but we've changed the paradigm so that the walls can be put in place, and we've put some really big ones that make it, a lot harder. But we haven't, you asked earlier, how can we show that this is not going to make matters worse? We can't show that this isn't going to make matters worse. And the only thing that can keep, last night we were at the band, you know, and like some of us thought it was a little loud, and I couldn't help looking at these wonderful players who were all playing drums and thinking, imagine what it would have been like if they didn't have microphones. What has our technology done to the sound of these drums? I just happen to love hand drums. You can't prevent that. You have electricity, people will start using microphones. So the only way that you can prevent bad things from happening socially is just with, you know, the kind of vigilance that we always have to have all the time about everything.
This is the part of the argument for an open approach to identity. In other words, that lots of people can discover problems and make solutions, and so you're opening it up to a broader community.
It all has to be inspectable.
There's a certain transparency about that becomes extremely important. And I know that IBM's been talking about this whole idea of open identity and security as a point of view. And if you, Tony, if I could just pick on you again to elaborate on that, because to me that represents a really interesting transition. I mean, there are a lot of people, when they think about tradition about security, it's a clamp down from the top, you lock everything down, and you try to have total control. And you have to, actually that doesn't work.
I mean,
that you have to flip it around, and you have to give incentives to a community to actually maintain, to make it secure, and make it transparent that way.
I mean, some of this has been going on for quite a while, right? As we start to bring the various protocols into the into open standards and stuff for people to look at, right? Security protocols are hard to get right, and they have to go through a lot of vetting practice. And so our first attempt is to take these things to standards body, with a collaboration of individuals at first, and then move it to make sure that this works. And our researchers have done the work to validate the protocols that don't have any holes in them and stuff. And, and then we move those into a standards body, to get wider adoption and get more eyes on these particular sets of protocols. And, so we are in this open space now as far as security protocols, and what we want to do now is bring in open source implementations. And some of these have been going on, like OpenSSL, OpenSAML, and stuff for a while. And so we believe that these things need to be brought out a little bit more as far as the open. And Microsoft's been helping along and committing to work on these sets of protocols. And hopefully they will endorse the open standards or the open source efforts here to make these available to individuals and stuff.
Okay. Mark, a question for you is, how does this, you're listening to this, and how does this strike you? Does it, you feel better, worse, skeptical, befuddled?
Well, I had a back to the future moment. I was just thinking about this discussion and remembering a hearing in Congress about 20 years ago proposing the expanded use of the Social Security number, and I may have been testifying before the House Ways and Means Committee, and I was trying to explain to the members of Congress what the problem was with the Social Security number as an identifier. And I said, well, you can think of the Social Security number as a universal, unique identifier. It's unique in the sense that it tries to uniquely identify individuals, but it's universal in that it could be broadly applied if there's no specific context. And I said the real goal, and this was about 20 years ago, was to develop a system of unique identifiers, that we wanted identifiers that would uniquely identify individuals within a unique context.
Right.
And we wanted them disconnected and disaggregated, and that, in fact, in certain respects, privacy laws and laws regulating the collection, the use of the Social Security number try to do that. The problem, of course, is that, 20 years ago, we didn't think so much about the reaggregation of identity.
Right.
So I'm on the one hand extraordinarily supportive and encouraged by the, obvious interest in trying to create what I think could be broadly understood as systems of unique identification, context-specific identification. And at the same time, very much concerned about the possibility to reconstruct identity in a way that may turn out to be far more detailed, right? I mean, let's sort of go down that level, because to the extent that these individual systems don't simply identify us as a customer of a bank, but have all the details associated with a transaction, or not simply a member of a blog community, but all the comments associated with that community, the reconstruction of that identity, is more about you than you know about yourself.
But do you see in any of the technologies being discussed here and the approach a way of addressing that, or do you think that's still on the table? Paul, want to answer that?
I just want to say I'm sometimes at Berkman the Microsoft apologist. There seems to be this meme that you put an identity system in place and by definition you've just moved the world closer to universal context-free identifiers. I don't know. I've found out that most people take that as the corollary. You say we're working on the, what's Microsoft CardSpace going to do for the world? Oh my God, highly scaled, distributed, admittedly, but common identity system, gets the hair back up on the back of the necks of a lot of people because they skip a step, and that in fact. I admit that, unfortunately, the last 20 years of technology makes correlation thousands of times easier than it was, but at least it's still worth the effort to build architectures and systems that mitigate against the common GUI, the big...
Yeah, but I think you misunderstood my comment, because I wasn't saying the hairs on my back thinking about people doing distributed identity. I think that's a great thing. But, and as I said, it's something I've been pushing for a very long time. But at the same time, I think we also, and this was the significance of the panel yesterday, really have to engage the question of what happens when it goes wrong. Now, if I can just sort of throw one other issue on the table, you know, which is interesting, I think, for lawyers and others, that keeps kind of peeking its head up in the realm of identification. And this is sort of this notion about how do you protect yourself against self-incrimination, the Fifth Amendment, you know, protection. I mean, people have financial records, and the government certainly has the right to prosecute you if you've engaged in financial misdealings, and they can gather evidence and bring a case. The question is whether they can force you to cooperate in that investigation, to literally sign your name to documents that lead to the disclosure of your personal financial information to those people who are investigating you and prosecuting you. Now, sort of, I won't go into the long history, but under 19th century view, you would have thought, well, of course not. I mean, the government can't force you to aid in the prosecution of you. But in fact, the court has decided over the last couple decades somewhat differently. It can force you to turn over those documents. It can force you to provide passwords. It could force you in a user-centric identity model to reconstruct information about you that could be used.
I just wanted to build on that point, because I mean, it seems like that, I mean, with the erosion of Fourth Amendment rights, in a sense, since it's not physical, it's not a physical kind of forcing, it doesn't seem to be so bad. Therefore, the line gets getting moved, and people don't recognize that this is a real infringement, and that there may be things like that in the digital world that we have not learned to protect because it's so new to us, and that we may be relinquishing rights, I mean, under that scenario. Is that what Tony?
But it seems like you're more aware in that environment that this is going on. In the other environment that we're in today, you have no clue that you're going through this process behind your back.
Oh, yeah.
So at least here with the user-centric, you will know that they are going to force you to do something.
And you can delete your
You can pre-delete everything as long as you have a good...
Yeah, because my understanding of some of the technology you're just talking about in Switzerland, is Itamex. I mean, it makes it difficult to do the linking. I mean, and I assume that there are ways in which to do the aggregations you're talking about, that they're countermeasures, and that so it's it, that is not just that's not going to be that'll be one of the rings of the fort that gets put in, and there are other kinds of technologies, the counter technologies that can do that. If your framework is broad enough, Paul, do you want to speak to
it? Well, it is definitely true that when you go to the user-centric model and you make it all convenient and you've got all this stuff in one place, you've just raised the value of the target of cracking that central place. But my answer to that is, rather than, people either do one of two things. They use the same username password all over the place, in which case that isn't too secure, or they use a nice, you know, spreadsheet or RoboForm or nice, write it down, all the different passwords they use, which isn't very good either. So what we're proposing is, we aggregate the information. We only aggregate it for the person who should see it, but at least we've got their full attention. And what I would probably like to see is that people use a very hard token or something physical that would lock their relationship to all that stuff. And I think with one thing to worry about, you're probably overall safer.
Yeah.
Yeah, I want to jump in here a little bit, but it's hard for a Novell guy to share a mic with an IBM guy. Yeah, that's right.
Will you guys stop fighting? All right.
No, it's an open mic.
Yeah, it's an open mic. Yeah, that's exactly what I'm getting to. I think this, Paul and Kim and Tony have all made excellent points, and so Mark, but you know, we're coming from technologists kind of ganging up on the guy in the middle. I think we are doing something a little bit different here. Paul said maybe this won't necessarily make it better. I think there is one aspect of this process that this panel shows that is different than how we've tried this in the past, and that is open collaboration to the point of open source collaboration around identity issues. And so therefore it's very important to me that however this problem is solved, it's done in open source to the point where people can see how their secrets are being handled, and that it's this whole area is so big and so difficult that we don't really even know for sure all the ramifications of it yet. So not only do they need to be able to see how their secrets are handled, but they need to participate in the development process for how these concepts evolve. So I think it should be open source development.
I just want to make one comment here, which is, I think one of the big changes in the past when we were dealing with security issues is we would have a threat model, what we call a security threat model. And or some of us did. No, under some circumstances. We usually did. And so any product or anything that was developed had to go through a security threat model. And I think what this generation of identity technologies has to do is go through a privacy threat model, which is a continuous, evolving thing with a progressively higher bar as we bring more people to understand it. So, for example, you know, being able to collaborate with people like Mark on thinking these things through is the equivalent of bringing in expertise to do your security threat model. And we as technologists, just like when we're dealing with security, we always tend to, you know, no matter how cynical we are, and I always pride myself in being infinitely cynical about technology.
That's a good question.
You know, even though I sound Pollyannic inside, it's just the opposite. You know, we need outsiders who are more cynical than we are so that we can get our points across within our community. So to me, that's really our only hope of going somewhere is to take these things and thoroughly expose them to vetting. Now, to me, that's more... Okay, this is going to sound very self-serving, but it's not that I'm against having the code inspectable and open and everything else, but I think it's the... You know, I mean, my children cannot inspect my code, you know. Most people I know can't inspect my code. I even published it on the web, and you know, a bunch of my friends who are engineers said they couldn't inspect my code.
Yeah, Kim, my son inspects my code, and he says it sucks.
That's painful.
Well, I wasn't saying why they
can't.
Right. But yeah, exactly. So, right. So I mean, the point is we need experts to inspect the code as well. Okay, anybody should be able to inspect. We need experts who are brought in to inspect the code. Right.
Mark,
I was just going to say, because it sounded like there was half an olive branch on the table, I want to put the other half out. I mean, I don't think, you know, people who are concerned about privacy should be viewed as in opposition to engineers and companies and investors and others who are trying to make privacy technologies work. I think in the grand scheme of things, we're all on the same side, and we share a common interest in seeing that they'd be made to work, and I think... You know, I mean, understanding something working means really working, and you get to kick the tires. So that's important. I just want to throw out one example, which I'm very interested and concerned about these days, and it has to do with electronic voting systems. We work with a lot of, you know, technologists on the problem of how to make electronic voting work. Now, there are probably a bunch of people in this room who are interested in that problem, but I'll tell you, there are two very important and conflicting interests in the design of electronic voting systems. One, on the one hand, you want it to be auditable and verifiable, and on the other hand, you want to preserve the secrecy of the ballot, right? You want to decouple a person's identity from their vote for lots and lots of reasons. I've been in a lot of meetings with a lot of people, very smart people, who said that's just too hard. I mean, we may not be able to keep the secret ballot in a digital environment. So we have a genuine interest in finding solutions to these problems.
Although it raises the question, does everything have to be technologized? Because I kind of believe that, you know, things like, you know, sex and voting might be better left in the physical world.
Dark, right?
just don't do them together.
How old-fashioned. But Mark, I want to follow up with a question. Is that, do you think that, two questions actually. One is that should anonymity be the default, or some kind of anonymity be the default of a system design?
Definitely. And then anonymity should be the default. Okay. And we haven't done the minimum necessary work to get this.
So then you would try to drive the definition of what real anonymity is into a lot of different circumstances. Would be a robust anonymity, maybe another correct. And then the other question I have is, things become contextual. Then you recognize under one set of circumstances, you may have a public self. You may be traveling, and the government's going to have some kind of say in terms of how you get authenticated and how the information is used, versus another self. And this is going to be technologically segmented, that you're going to have to think about legal regimes mapping on to those technology architectures, and they become interwoven in new ways. And we talked a little bit about sort of the intersection between law and technology. And do you see that happening, that kind of thing?
Yeah.
Really have to be informed that way, which a lot of legislators are not.
Right.
There's a real disconnect here in understanding these things, hence a default to a much simpler model.
Well, I don't mean to do golden oldies here, but the other Back to the Future moment I had was thinking about the early days of the introduction of caller ID. Caller ID was actually a very interesting service when it first was rolled out, because it confronted people, really for the first time, with a question of disclosure of identity in an electronic environment. They had never really thought much that when they picked up a phone, someone would know who they were before they identified themselves. And I was very much involved in those proceedings, but I basically took away from that two lessons. I mean, one, opt-in really does make sense. I mean, people really do not want to have the default set against them.
Right.
They would like to affirmatively disclose their identity. Otherwise, they can't control their identity. And the other thing which we learned, which was interesting, is that identity turns out to be highly dynamic. That people in some situations who you'd
right.
be quite happy to disclose your identity to, in others you wouldn't. And like the best example is your supervisor. Depending on whether or not you've got your project done, you know, you're not there, right? But the interactions on a telephone are wildly different with the same person depending on the particular circumstance. It's very hard to capture that.
Really good point.
At least in our organization,
we have some questions on the screen here, and maybe you can turn around, if you can read them off your machine. But I'll read it aloud. And the first one is: if all this stuff happens, the identity selector in whichever platform will be massively attacked by malware trying to get root. Will identity selector software need a hardware trusted computing base, i.e. a TPM? Sooner or later. Does anyone want to answer that?
Yeah, we got to get there before people can attack what we put in place while we're getting there. So this is war, basically. I mean, I don't like war metaphors, Doc, forgive me. But, you know, against the attacks, it's really a serious thing. I get briefed on them, quite regularly, and it's just so depressing. So, you know, we have to really, ultimately we will have, maybe that is a good use for a trusted computer environment. We need one, don't we? So, protecting our personal information is a use. But on the other hand, you have to look at other characteristics of the system. So, for example, in the card space implementation, we don't keep data on the PC. The data is kept in the identity provider, which, as I said, can live wherever it wants, let's say in the cloud, in a place that has armed guards around it. And so in that sense, it can be, because it's signed and everything and can be encrypted. I mean, you give up certain privacy things if you encrypt it, because now the identity provider knows who it's talking to. But if you do have that encryption, it now doesn't even appear on the client, and so it can't even be seen on the client, because it's end-to-end encryption. So, you know, this has to be looked at in a lot of detail to understand all of the different options that you have. But some of the options actually remove the client as a threat model, as a threat within the system. And in the best of cases, you have two parties approving every transaction. Because I can also give you lots of examples where you know, the user is not involved. Like, let's look at some of those, the credit bureau cases where information was leaked from the credit bureau to a bunch of scam artists. Why were they leaking it? It was because the user had no idea that information was going about them. And, you know, if they had been notified, they would have been able to say, well, I have no dealings with these people, don't release the information. But in the current way that we do things, they aren't consulted. The information is just released. In the type of system that we are proposing, Higgins as well as InfoCard and others, card
get
space,
it right.
the whole information card model, you have the vetting of the transfer of information by two parties. One is the user, who decides whether it should be released. The other is the identity provider, who decides whether they want it released. So let's say you were talking about Visa transactions. Even if I am duped as an end user, the Visa system gets to verify that endpoint and decide whether the transaction is going to be released to that endpoint. So it turns out to have... that's a case where, because it's a financial transaction, I don't want the privacy benefit as much as I want the auditing benefit. You know, unfortunately, you have to keep trading one thing off another, and so you know that's why it's a question of keeping all the contexts insulated from each other and then finding out what is actually needed in that context. But it's this type of power in the system that makes me more optimistic. Than it's not a simplistic system where all the stuff is just dumped on the client and somebody can come in and steal it.
Yeah, I want to comment on the overall question and Kim's response as well. That on the one hand, I agree with everything Kim said. We do need to eventually have a clear authentication path for all the entities involved in interactions. But identity systems are about relationships between things, and like we've talked about, it can be very complex, and we don't even know what the correct model is sometimes. And it seems like a lot of times we get the perspective, and this question seems to resonate with that to me, that we're designing the matrix-like world, and the digital me is this world that we live in, and we have to nail it down tighter and tighter and tighter to a single chip, to a single identifier. That is me in that world, and I think that's not the right model. That the model is more like, I've read some interesting work about that the internet more follows a organic ecosystem model than an engineering model. We need to follow these engineering plans, but this is all going to work itself out over time.
So this wouldn't be a good idea then?
Well, I'm not saying this is a bad idea, but I also think this also gets back to the voting machine discussions that...
Yeah,
I've got the mic now, Tony. Sorry. This gets back to the voting machine discussions that a mix between the physical world and and the evolving digital me world is not a bad thing while we sort some of these issues out. That we have a very varied system of voting machines now. Introducing some digital voting mechanisms and trying to sort out the conflicting requirements is a good thing. The same thing with the TPM thing. Life exists through attributes and evolving identities over time. We need to factor that into the system rather than just tighten it down to a single authentication mechanism.
Okay. So. We'll grab the mic.
So I do believe that TPM chips will help, right? Because they actually can make attestations about your environment. So if I'm happening to generate this particular message on a PC that has the Netsky virus or something, or doesn't have particular patches on it, you know, I can attach that attestation to my request. So it's going to give us a better picture of the environments that these messages were generated in, or these tokens were actually generated in. So it will help us understand, you know, what's happened. What was the message? What was the message path that was involved here? You know, how was it created? What base of software was it on?
Yeah.
Is it a software base that I can actually trust?
Like I would never go to a voting machine that wasn't on a TPM based system.
That's right.
And then I wouldn't go on a TPM based system that Mark hadn't verified for me.
You don't know that I'd count your vote.
I'd be voting in the right direction, of course. No, I mean, no, I don't say that. I can't vote, so I can say whatever I want about the political process. And besides, I don't understand the landscape here.
You have a paper ballot in Canada, actually. It's been very successful.
We have them, and I love them. I just love that feel of paper. You know, it's so retro. It's, and you know what? It takes about 10 minutes to count them. So. Well, you know, we take one person from each party, of which we have dozens. So there's lots of vetting, and we stick them in a room, and they all have to arrive at the same number. And, you know, since most people know how to count, this can happen fairly quickly.
Not in Florida.
But and not in... Well, everything becomes
all
harder
right,
in retrospect.
We get some questions from the floor.
Both.
Okay, yeah.
Well, I'm just going to jump in and say that one of my current privacy nightmares has to do with a Florida-based company, Digital Angel, that is actively promoting the implantation of RFID chips. I mean, really, you know,
There was a paper written for the Pet Privacy Conference coming up about how the real problem with that is that people will start cutting off your arm.
Right. I mean, this was a great episode for CSI Miami. I don't know how many people watch that show. It's excellent, by the way, if you're trying to stay up to date with criminal forensics. But it gets... I mean, let's be honest. That's how we do research now, right? But it gets...
I hope you're paid for that.
It was really creepy. The RFID episode was creepy.
It is creepy.
One quick question I have, this whole question of recourse and what happens in the industry. In other words, and this gets into the question...
Before we get there, I'd just like to take one stab, because I think it's a very cogent question.
Okay.
You could imagine... For example, being able to have multiple unrelated, following Paul's principle of having these different contexts, you could have multiple telephone numbers in one phone. Those telephone numbers could be associated with personas, some of which might even be essentially anonymous. They're still trackable, et cetera, so not anonymous in the full sense. So you can imagine multiple identifiers on one device, multiple devices with the same identifier. I would have my identity that's both on my computer and my telephone and on my iPod. So now, is it the device? I'm going to leave the mapping between the device and the human, because I think there's also advantages, as Tony was saying, around the device being able to attest to its health, right, in a way that you can trust it. But that's sort of a very technical thing that is best left for, you know, really technical discussions about isolation and so on and control inside the operating system.
I think it's a very interesting question up there. Do we need identities that we can plausibly deny owning? Do we need identity selectors with duress, coercion, alarms? And to that point, I think that if there aren't a multitude of identity providers and you don't have real choice, and say it devolves, power law comes in, and it's a huge cost of change, then at some point you're going to get some kind of coercion that's going to take place. And so what is the antidote to that? That may not be a form of coercion.
Now I'll do sort of an update on the congressional hearing process. But I testified at a hearing a couple months ago, or even last month, I think, and it's a very closely related issue. It had to do with whether spoofing telephone identity should be criminalized, right? I mean, there's legislation in the House that would basically make it a crime if you provided call setup information that wasn't, in fact, your call setup information. And I testified in opposition to the bill. I basically said, I think there should be an intent requirement that you're trying to do something wrong, right? I mean, it's a fraud or theft or something else. Because I could imagine lots of circumstances where people might spoof their identity. And I found that I had on my side a representative from Nebraska in whose district is one of the largest calling centers in the United States. And it turns out that calling centers take on the identity of their clients and make calls on behalf of their clients. And of course, the last thing they wanted was a bill to criminalize spoofing. So here I was, the privacy advocate, opposing spoofing, defending telemarketers. Go figure. Yeah, well, he kind of raced out of the hearing quickly. I don't know if it was a meeting with a probation officer or something.
Okay. Just wondering how this all maps to services in Web 2.0. Of course, we have services acting on our behalf that we call, that they call other services in a chain before we get back to receive the information that we requested. So I'm going to delegate an agent in a way to do my bidding, and that agent might call forth a number of other agents. So is that, I don't know how that.
Well, that's actually one of the very best advantages of this technology is that we can now separate the agent, because it's based on asymmetric keys, which mean that, what it means is that I can give you a coupon, basically, which allows you to act on my behalf, and I'm not giving you my identity. I'm giving you a coupon. I'm giving you a, let's say you're a calendar service. I'm giving your calendar service Kim Cameron's coupon to book meetings from 7 till 10 at night. So that's really different than from some of the earlier technologies we've had, like Kerberos and so on, where we were all tied into symmetric keys. All we had was a secret. And so you couldn't really delegate easily because it meant giving your secret to, you can see that now because you have some of these things on the web where the way you delegate to a service is you give the service your password. Well, I wouldn't do that myself. I don't want to give the service my password. I don't want to let the service be me. I want it to be the service with a coupon from me. And I think all of our technology, that's one of the things about the whole WS Trust Stack, at least, and other things like SAML, that's what they're aiming to achieve.
Yeah, a lot of these issues that we're talking about here, we tend to think of identity as being humans, but I think all of the projects and protocols that we've been talking about implementing these things have to do with that there's lots of kinds of identities. There's machine identities, there's conceptual identities, things like delegation, things like roles. I was in a session earlier today moderated by Mary Rundle, where one of the speakers mentioned the do not call list and the issues there involved in the scaling of being able to say, do not have anybody call, I only want them to be able to call me, and how difficult that is to map on a one-to-one basis, whereas I think in real life we naturally map that to a conceptual identity that we call telemarketers. Do not let telemarketers call. So this whole thing that in real life we have almost a role-based system on top of our identities, that's an area that we're getting to implement, and I think that will be necessary for Web 2.0. And I want to...
I'm not a telemarketer. I'm a refrigeration consultant for the home. Okay. I live in Washington State, and I've got a... I'm starting to get these... I do research into refrigeration issues.
I always wondered what Kim did.
No, I mean, this is what...
I was just going to make one... I was actually leading up to plugging my own project, which does role-based systems on top of Higgins is one of the components that it does. So check out the Bandit project. Because if I've got a mic, I should at least plug my own technology.
I wasn't trying to speak against rules. I was trying to speak against negative assertions.
Yeah.
So if you make the assertion, well...
I still figured you were a telemarketer if you were a refrigeration specialist.
Speaking of identity, I just wanted to say I've been receiving emails from people who are sending me their proxies, and I wanted to thank Daffy Duck, Mickey Mouse, Batman, and Storm.
Any more questions? Okay, right there. You all can't get down.
I don't know about the code, but I know that there are two words, actually three words, two of them are hyphenated in the policy world, and that is opt-in scales. Really? I mean, the selection, and in fact this is true in the do not call list scheme, there's nothing that prevents a company that you have established a relationship with from contacting you. The question is whether companies can contact you where there isn't a pre-existing relationship. So as long as it's built around opt-in, in fact, you can build outward, really, I think, without many privacy obstacles.
Nobody is supposed to call me unless it's someone where I've bought something. Now, if I bought something once from one company and I didn't like them, they still have the right to call me unless I go to that company's specific list and tell them not to call me. So it's not very easy. And I think that opt-in probably does scale, but there's so much commercial resistance to opt-in that we sort of have this bastardization of a system right now where it's a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and all they have to do is say they're not selling refrigerators, they're doing market research around refrigerators.
Well, so, but I don't want to be misinterpreted because that opt-in list is it's the most significant improvement in the quality of my life in the last 15
years.
And
here's an interesting fact. More people have signed up for the opt-in list then voted for the last president of the United States and his opponent combined. What does that tell you?
That we don't like telemarketing calls.
Telemarketing.
But it again, I agree with you, Kim. It's tremendous. It's like the most popular thing the Federal Trade Commission has ever done. Holds a special place in my heart. But it is very blunt. There's not a lot of granularity in there if I want to hear from the Echo cars and the green companies.
But maybe when the telephone system and the rest of the computing system are all integrated, which is just around the corner, you'll be able to be a lot more, and roles, you'll be able to say, okay, it's like saying, what do I trust? You should always say, what do I trust for something? And in this case, who do I trust to call me, really, and who don't I trust? Mm. But again, I don't really know if the negative assertion is useful because over time, people just, all they have to do is become anyone other than that negative assertion.
Right. And they're in.
And they're in again.
So that was a good point about reputation as a way of getting around.
Yeah, reputation is a better way.
Right.
Yeah. I also find it interesting that the one company I can't opt out from and that doesn't apply on the do not call list is the phone company.
Well, come on.
Lobbies.
Or Skype.
Yeah, yep.
Saying that now that we have these electronic things, we have to be more careful or more aware. We want to be, this wasn't possible before and now it's possible. All of that stuff makes perfect sense to me. But I'd like to come at it from the other side and see if I draw any contradictions. There's a lot of arguments out there that say, oh, this is different because it's electronic, which are just pure, unadulterated lying and bullshit. For example, in California, and I don't know if this comes from Spanish common law, which comes from the Gothic tribes, or whether it comes from English common law or what, but in California, any person at any time can use any name without permission from anybody, as long as they're not using it for a criminal purpose. And to say that the electronic world is different and therefore we should change that, I'm going to say is phony, and I want to see if I draw any contradiction from that. That was good enough for the last 500 or 1,000 years, and it's good enough for the future.
Happens today.
Wise one. Tell us.
Any more questions?
Okay, what we're doing?
We did find the cards.
Okay. Greg, you want to introduce those? Yeah,
John, I got one question real quick.
What's that?
One question?
Sure.
Just want to ask you guys, what do you feel the role of artists are in this identity dialogue? I'll give just two quick examples, Madonna and Sting.
I don't know. I mean, the role of artists are to transform the world into whatever they're trying to achieve.
By that,
so in that
do you
sense,
mean,
I think it's quite I think it's sort of orthogonal.
By that, do you mean Madonna and Sting, the people or the brands?
Are you talking about the music distribution issue?
How do you know their identity? I think Kim would want Madonna in the physical world.
Speak for yourself. Wait. Brett?
I just wanted to mention, when it comes to the artist, again, I guess you could talk about privacy for celebrities, or you can talk about, you know, the benefits to the individual content producer in a identity-enabled world, and I think those are clear. It's not digital rights management, but it's actually identity management is another enabling technology for the individual as a content distributor, and web services, discovery and invocation of services for that content, I think is a real opportunity that we don't talk much about, but this infrastructure supports.
So that is, so digital rights today is generally tied to a device, right, and not tied to an individual. And there is, right. I think there's a need to move change that, so that when I do buy a song from whoever, whether it's the founder or the Beatles, that I get the rights to it, not a particular device. They still want to control what device it's playing through, but it's my right to it. And there is a lot of work in the industry around that term, around doing that. Right? Right.
So this goes back to the issue, the case where the student was selling a song on eBay, right? And the iTunes song, he tried to sell the song on eBay, and Apple came against him because it was for the particular device. It wasn't actually him. So there's court case going on right now with that individual trying to sell the song, and Apple saying no, this belongs to the particular device.
It belonged to the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep.
It was the iPod song.
Not the individual who actually went through the money and purchased it. And on his credit card, it's against the device. Yep.
Sony's rootkit is another hole that boggles the mind.
Yeah, that's.
But then the other thing around this is there's this woman, Alice Tiara, who has a blog called tiara.org. and writes about identity. She's really, really interesting. And she wrote this piece on micro-celebrity. She writes about micro-celebrity. And so, in a sense, there's an aspect of the artist, which is the youth, if you want. I mean, that whole micro-celebrity thing of Facebook and so on. And then the fact that the persona, the artistic persona of the young person is being squished into reality, and that becomes equated with, the job search vetting, by corporations and so on. So to me, the question of art and poets and artists and so on is also related to this question of the micro-celebrity and is much broader than just, the sort of top of the heap.
Okay, that should be. Is there one last question here?
Flamboyant misconception of the question, which is worth explaining.
Which one?
On the left.
I'm going to read it.
The top one.
Yeah, that's the...
Can we get more technical?
You mean the one about could the hacker use the preview mode? Okay, the card space runs in a separate process space in a separate desktop, so it can't actually be seen by a Trojan that infects your normal desktop. Yeah. For example, if you look, if you have remote software that connects to your buddy, so you can say do net meeting or something off your PC, you won't be able to see the card space on the other machine. There are really, really extreme, I'm not saying that it is not possible to break across this boundary, but I will say it's several orders of magnitude different from the current situation. And to me, an order of magnitude, I'm a physicist, I'm talking 10. So in fact, the Trojan is not going to see your card space. It can't, in the typical scenario, there are no keystrokes because you're not typing a password, so it can't steal your keystrokes. You can't bring up an alternate thing that looks like it because the attacker doesn't know what cards you've got in your wallet, so to speak, so it can't produce a wallet that is credibly similar to yours. So anyway, anybody who's interested in these issues, I'd love to talk to you offline and we can go through. This has been quite well, I've spent a lot of time with a lot of people thinking this through and being attacked, by literally 10,000 people in a good way, in the sense of doing the security and privacy threat analysis.
Great. Okay, we'll conclude our panel, give a hand for the panel.